following audio is from Life Connection Church. We exist to glorify God through transformed lives by the power of the gospel. For more information about Life Connection Church, visit www.lifeconnectionkc.org.
So, we are in our second week of our teaching series about how God dwells among us. And the goal of this is to show how the Bible, from Genesis to Revelation, this large book, 66 different books in it, is telling a story of how God's desire is to live with his people. So last week we looked at how God created the world and blessed humanity. So we saw in Genesis chapter 1, verses 27 through 28, and the scriptures should be on the screen as I go. We read that God created man in his own image. The image of God, he created him. Male and female, he created them. And God blessed them, and God said to them, "Be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth and subdue it." So God created us in his image, which means that he created us with a mind and a heart that are similar to his. And he did that so that we can live in his world as his ambassadors. We are to be a blessing to the world, creating more image bearers, more people made in his image. And then he placed us, in Genesis 2, in a garden in Eden. And Eden is where heaven and earth met. It's where God walked with humanity. It's where his life-giving presence flowed out into the rest of the world. And what we see is that even living in that place, in God's full and unhindered presence, it was not enough for Adam and Eve. Because in Genesis chapter 3, they are tempted by Satan himself to rebel against God. And the temptation is this: you can be your own moral authority. You can be God. And so they chose to reject God. And God, as a punishment, banished them from his presence from Eden. And before he banished them, he did lay out a promise to them. In Genesis chapter 3, verse 15, speaking to Satan, God says, "I will put enmity between you and the woman, and between your offspring and her offspring. He shall bruise your head, and you shall bruise his heel." So here's the promise that God makes. One day, someone will be born who will crush you. And it will hurt him, but he will do it. All of that happens in the first three chapters of the Bible. And that is a huge book. And the rest of the story is about how God is fulfilling that promise. And so as you read through Genesis, what you see is over and over again, God's reaffirming this promise to his people. So as we work our way to Genesis 28, I want to read through a few of those passages. Just to help you see how God is creating this thread that as a reader, we should be looking for these things. We should be looking for this offspring that he's been promising. And as I do, I want you to keep in mind or keep your eyes open for the words bless, multiply, offspring, earth. Like just keep your eyes open for those. The first one that I want you to see is in Genesis 12, where God, after centuries of humanity rebelling against him, approaches a man named Abram. In Genesis chapter 12, verses 1 through 3. "Now the Lord said to Abram, 'Go from your country and your kindred and your father's house to the land that I will show you. And I will make of you a great nation, and I will bless you and make your name great, so that you will be a blessing. I will bless those who bless you, and him who dishonors you I will curse, and in you all the families of the earth shall be blessed.'" Abram eventually becomes Abraham, just if you want to make that connection. But what you see here, that the promise of Genesis chapter 1, the blessing of Adam, is now passed on to Abraham. And Abraham is given the same task. You will be a blessing to the world. You will be my ambassadors. And he repeats this to Abraham over and over and over again throughout his life. And when Abraham dies, he passes down this promise to his son Isaac. So in Genesis chapter 26, God speaks to Isaac. And he says, I will be with you and will bless you. For to you and to your offspring I will give these lands. And I will establish the oath that I swore to Abraham your father. I will multiply your offspring as the stars of heaven and will give to your offspring all these lands. And in your offspring all the nations of the earth shall be blessed. Once again, the promises of Genesis 1 and 2 are passed down from Abraham to Isaac. You will be the way that I bless the world. And this brings us to our passage today in Genesis 28, into Abraham's grandson and Isaac's son, Jacob. Here's the thing, though, as we read Genesis 28, you should know that Jacob's not really that great of a dude. His name actually means he cheats, and that fits because that's exactly what he did most of his early life. As you read the story of Jacob, you see that he manipulated his brother multiple times. In fact, there was one moment where Jacob waited until Esau felt that he was about to die from starvation and used that against Esau to get Esau to give him his future inheritance. And then there was another time where he tricked his father, who was blind, by the way, into blessing him with Esau's blessing. And that's a huge deal. The blessing to the older son means you're taking over the family legacy. And Jacob tricked his father into that. And he had help. It's a messed up family. You can read that story on your own. But what we see is that as we come to Genesis 28, is Jacob is actually running away from home because his brother has threatened to kill him. He's a con man who has torn his family apart for selfish reasons, for material blessings. And it's in Genesis 28 where we come to this point where God reveals himself to Jacob. And what we're going to see this morning is that is what Jacob shows us is that knowing God changes us. Knowing God changes us. Like the question before us is, after Genesis 3, how in the world can God restore us? And we're going to see how he does that with Jacob. And so, the first thing we're going to see as we read through chapter 28 is we're going to see how God graciously reveals himself to us and graciously reveals himself to Jacob. So, starting in verse 10, read with me follow along as I read down to verse 16. So, Jacob left Beersheba and went toward Haran. He's moving east. And he came to a certain place and stayed there that night because the sun had set. Taking one of the stones of the place, he put it under his head and lay down in that place to sleep. And he dreamed, and behold, there was a ladder set up on the earth, and the top of it reached to heaven. And behold, the angels of God were ascending and descending on it. And behold, the Lord stood above it and said, I am the Lord, the God of Abraham, your father, and the God of Isaac. The land on which you lie, I will give to you and to your offspring. Your offspring shall be like the dust of the earth, and you shall spread abroad to the west and to the east and to the north and to the south. And in you and your offspring shall all the families of the earth be blessed. Behold, I am with you and will keep you wherever you go, and I will bring you back to this land. For I will not leave you until I have done what I have promised you. Then Jacob awoke from his sleep and said, surely the Lord is in this place, and I did not know it. God graciously reveals himself here. And I say graciously because Jacob isn't looking for God. It's not like he's on some vision quest out in the middle of the wilderness smoking peyote, you know, hoping to get something from the Lord. And he's not out, like, he's not a priest, he's not a monk out there, just me and Jesus, me and my word. Like, he is running away from home. Like, his circumstance is so bad, he's using a rock as a pillow. And it's in that dark, lonely place that Jacob got himself into, by the way, that God graciously reveals himself. He interrupts Jacob's life. Not because Jacob asked him to, but because God wants to. He has a new path for Jacob to walk down. And here at his lowest moment, the creator of heaven and earth pulls back the curtain of Jacob's reality and reveals what's really going on. You know, I've heard of people talk about how some of the most common places people find God are like in prison or in rehab, like these really low places. And they talk about it like, of course they find God there. Where else are they going to go? Like they're like it's almost like it's a weakness. What if instead of being a weakness, it's just God having to humble us enough so we'll actually listen to him? What if Jacob had to come to this place because outside of all of his failure and sin, he would never have seen God? God is not dumb. He knows what it takes for us to actually get our attention. And because he's so important, he's willing to do those things and allow those things and ordain those things to happen. Like even for those of us who follow Jesus, there's a strong temptation to believe that our lives hinge on our own abilities and our own strength and our own wisdom. And we can still operate out of that lie of Genesis chapter 3 where, you know, I'm my moral authority. I'm in control of everything. It's almost like we tell God, like, you've served your purpose, now just let me do it. And God will let you do it. And he'll let you hit rock bottom again so that he can reveal himself yet again to you and who he is so you can know that he is there and that he is the answer to what you need. What does God actually show Jacob here? What does he show him that we need to see? Like, the author here actually helps us out because four times he uses this word, behold. And just when you're reading the Bible, if you come across that word, behold, even if you're kind of like not paying attention, just take a moment, catch your breath. It's like, all right, I need to pay attention to what's coming after this. And so what does he show us here? He shows us four different things because there's four times he says, behold. The first thing he shows us in verse 12 is he says that God has not abandoned us. He says there's this ladder on earth that reached up to heaven. Eden in Genesis chapter 2 is the place where heaven and earth connect. And what Jacob is seeing here is that God has not broken that connection just because we've rejected him. He's not abandoned us. Like if someone frustrates us and angers us, we might cancel them, right? We might just get out of the way, like they're out of my life. God has not done that with us. Because he's not like us. He's not petty like we are, or we can be. He is gracious. The second thing we see is that God is still actively engaged. He says the angels of God were going up and down this ladder, or this staircase, depending on your translation. Like most faiths talk about how can we get to heaven? But here what we see is that heaven is actually coming down to earth. And his messengers, his angels, are still serving God's will. And so they're coming to earth to be actively engaged in the lives of us, of his people. God not only has not abandoned us, but he's still working in the earth and in the world. The third thing we see in verse 13 is that God is still ruling over his world. It says the Lord stood above the staircase or the ladder. That's a place of authority. He's commanding his angels. He's looking over the world. It may seem at times like our whole existence is just happening outside of God's gaze. Like he may be looking in and checking in on other people, but he is ignoring me. And what we see here is that is absolutely a lie. God is still sovereign. He is still in control. And he still sees you. He has not forsaken you. He has not abandoned you. He is still active actively working in your life, and he is still ruling over the world. And lastly, what we see in verse 15 is that God is still with us. He says, behold, I will be with you. It's a promise that's really reminiscent of Jesus' final words to his disciples in Matthew 28. And lo, or behold, I am with you always to the end of the age. God not only sees you, he's not only ruling over your life, but he is walking with you through it. That's what he's showing Jacob. That's what he's wanting us to see. And remember, this man is a man who has not earned this, right? He's not seeking this or looking for this, but God, out of his grace, is opening his eyes to see it. He is showing him how committed he is to accomplishing his plan. Like, our sin does not move God to forsake us. Rather, what we see is that it actually moves God to more earnestly seek to save us. That's how great his love for us is. And we see this over and over and over again throughout the scriptures, throughout the story of the Bible. God graciously taking the initiative to reveal himself to sinful people over and over, all of it ultimately culminating in his son, Jesus. The apostle John, who knew Jesus and walked alongside Jesus for 3 years, describes Jesus like this in John chapter 1. And he says, and the Word, who is God, became flesh and dwelt among us. And we have seen his glory, glory as of the only Son from the Father, full of grace and truth. No one has ever seen God, the only God, who is at the Father's side. He has made him known. Jesus has revealed to us the heart of God. When you read about Jesus in the Gospels and you hear his words and you see his actions, you are hearing the words of God and seeing the actions of God. I mean, in fact, Jesus actually describes himself by referencing this story in Genesis 28. In talking to one of his disciples, he says, truly, truly, I say to you, you will see heaven opened and the angels of God ascending and descending on the Son of Man. That title, Son of Man, is a title that Jesus used for himself a lot. And what he's saying is, I am the ultimate way that God is connected here to earth. I am the way that God is working in our world today. I am the way you can ascend up to God one day. I am the way that God is with you now. Like in the midst of our self-made darkness and shame and guilt, God sent the light of the world, his only Son. And in the life of Jesus, you see most clearly and plainly that God has not only not given up on you, but that he is actively working to save you. That he is sovereignly committed to his plan to rescue you and live with you and dwell with you, and you dwell with him. And he accomplished this by literally walking among us, taking on human flesh to live as we live and to suffer as we suffer. And in Jesus' death and resurrection, God absorbed the punishment, the wrath that you and I deserve for rejecting him, so that he could give us the life we could never earn on our own. Like, if you are in that dark place this morning and you're wondering, all right, where is God at in all this? Let's get our eyes up onto Jesus. Look at him on the cross for you, carrying your sin and your shame and your guilt that you could not ever pay for on your own. and bring every single thing you have to offer to him. Because on the cross, he will take all your failures. And he'll take all the shame you feel, things for things you've done or things that have been done to you. And he'll take all the guilt that you bring. And he'll take it off of you and give you a new life. A life lived in the presence of God. A life where you can cling to that promise of Matthew 28 that he is with you always and he'll never forsake you. The promise of Genesis 28:15 can be a promise that you take a hold of this morning that God is with me. Knowing God like this changes us. Knowing God changes us. And we see that that's exactly what happens with Jacob. Like if you're looking for a new direction, it begins not by just saying, I'm going to try harder. It begins by getting your gaze up on the Lord. And when that happens, he begins to change you. And we see that happening in the life of Jacob. So let's look at this together as we see that God's revelation changes us here. And starting in verse 16, reading down to verse 22. Just watch how this changes Jacob. Then Jacob awoke and from his sleep and said, surely the Lord is in this place and I did not know it. And he was afraid and said, how awesome is this place? This is none other than the house of God. This is the gate of heaven. So early in the morning, Jacob took the stone that he had put under his head and set it up for a pillar and poured oil on the top of it. He called the name of that place Bethel, but the name of the city was Luz at the first. Then Jacob made a vow saying, if God will be with me and will keep me in this way that I go and will give me bread to eat and clothing to wear so that I come again to my father's house in peace, then the Lord shall be my God and this stone which I have set up for a pillar shall be God's house. And of all that you give me, I will give a full tenth to you. So Jacob awakes from this dream a changed man. And there are a few things that we see that show how this has transformed him. The first thing we see is that he awakes with a healthy fear of God. He's living with a fear of God. Like he says, he wakes up and is afraid. Like this language of fear of God, it actually scares us a little bit. We're like, man, we shouldn't be afraid of God, right? He loves us. Like God should be someone we can feel comfortable with. And I'm like, yes and no. Like, the fear of God is a healthy fear if you actually know who God is. Having a fear of God or being in awe of him shows that you really understand who he is. Like I've used this analogy before. Like if you live in a house with a house cat, like you might have to feed the cat. Odds are you're going to go days without seeing that cat, more than likely. Your every move in that house is not going to be determined by where the cat is. But if you live in a house with a lion, you wake up wondering, where's the lion at? It changes every move you make. It affects everything you do. The lion may be your pet, and you may feel it loves you, but you know in any moment it could rip your head off. There's a difference between a domesticated view of God and knowing the real God, who is the holy and righteous creator of all that we know and see, and knows everything that you've done and in your heart has the right to judge and condemn you. Standing before that God should create some fear. And what we see over and over again throughout the scriptures is that when even the holiest of men get a view of that God, it makes them pass out. I'm thinking of Isaiah in Isaiah 6 or the Apostle John in Revelation chapter 1. Because God is a real being, he is not up for us to figure out who he is by our own imagination. But as he tells us who he is, we need to receive that. And one of the appropriate reactions is it's going to cause us to shake a little bit. Especially when we begin to compare ourselves to him. I mean, if you think about the opposite effect of this. Like a God who you don't fear is a God who you ultimately don't take seriously. And a God you don't take seriously is a God who has no control over you and therefore really can't help you. A God that you don't fear is really a God that can only ever approve of what you do. And so if you're here this morning, you're like, well, I know all of this about Jesus, everything you said earlier, but I'm struggling to see change in my life. The question, maybe the first question you have to answer is, do you really fear God? Is the God you worship a God that you've made in your own image? Or to put it another way, do you explain away God's holiness so that you don't have to feel guilt about your sin? Do you explain away God's power so that you don't have to rely on him? Jacob had to come face to face with the God who is beyond his imagination, not only in his holiness and justice, but also in his grace and mercy and love. I'm sure that Jacob thought, if I ever come face to face with God, it will not be a gracious moment. But yet here he is, receiving the promises of God. And that's what we see in the gospel too. Getting your eyes up onto the cross of Jesus shows you and helps you see that the justice of God took nothing less than the death of his own son to pay for your sin. And it also shows you the great love of God because the Father and the Son willingly did that for you. Like if you're struggling to see transformation in your life, it could be because you don't live in awe of God as you should. And the best place to start this morning is by just thanking on the cross of Jesus. What had to be done for you and what God willingly did do for you. That's the first thing we notice about Jacob and his transformation. The second thing we notice about Jacob and his transformation is he vowed to live in God's presence. Like it's interesting because his vow, if you read it, is like, oh, it's conditional. Like God, he's basically saying, God, if you actually do what you said you'll do, then you'll be my God. And what you should understand is this is like the guy who tells Jesus, I believe, but help me believe. This is the first time in the story of Jacob where he actually talks to God at all. This is the prayer of someone who's just come to believe. And he's saying, Lord, I want to trust you. So I'm going to live as if I trust you, and I will have you be my God if you're trustworthy. And here's the thing, God is incredibly trustworthy. There's not one promise that God makes Jacob that he doesn't fulfill. Not one. And so what if you did what Jacob did here? You take the promises of God that you've heard this morning and you commit to follow him as long as he fulfills those promises. I think that would highly honor the Lord this morning. Because here's the thing. He's never, ever going to fail you. And the first promise that God ever fails to keep will be the first promise he's ever failed to keep. For him to lie to you would mean that he would have to somehow stop being God. That there's something he could not do in order to accomplish his purpose. This is why he's trustworthy. He never fails you, and he never will. And I want you to notice something else here. Jacob's view of his life is changed, but the journey he's on doesn't really change. He's still heading east. Like for most of us here, trusting God on a day-to-day basis isn't going to change much of what we do on a day-to-day basis. But it can change the mindset in which we do those things. Because now I know that my day-to-day life is lived in the presence of God. And so it creates this intentionality in us. Remember, God's plan for Jacob, his plan for us, is that he would bless us so then he could bless others through us. His presence in us, his gifts toward us, would then pour out of us into others. And so, you know, over the last month or two, we talked about that question of who's your one? We really ramped up that question toward Easter. And the question is basically like, who's one person in your life, whether it's from work, from your street, from your family, whoever, that you're going to seek to bless and serve and share the gospel with? And now that Easter has come and gone, how can you answer that question? Do you still have that person in your mind? That's just intentionally in your head. You don't have to change a whole lot. Living the Christian life doesn't mean you have to be a missionary overseas. Doesn't mean you have to plant churches like Sea Clay. Doesn't mean you have to even, like, be a great communicator. All it means is that you live your life intentionally, knowing that God is with you in your everyday activities. And that you're just going to honor him in those. Honor him in your being a parent. Honor him in being a student. Honor him in being a hard worker and a good employee. Honor him in being a friend and being a neighbor. Striving to be a blessing. Striving to be good news to those around you. That's what God has created you for. And there are times I feel like we want to see transformation happen in our life. But sometimes that transformation is not going to come until we live with that intentionality of actually honoring the Lord in the everyday parts of our lives. That's what God wants. So are you doing that? And then lastly, the last thing we see in Jacob is that he commits to live generously. That's part of that intentionality. He commits to give a tenth of everything that God gives him back to God. And those last few verses here that he's talking about, they're like temple language. He's setting up temple, like temple worship. He doesn't even really know it, I don't think. And there's this old, like, Jewish, I don't know if it's a myth or what, but they actually believe, or somewhere along the line, that the stone that Jacob pours the oil on becomes the cornerstone of Solomon's temple. I don't know if that's true, but that's how highly they revere this story. And Jacob is saying, if you fulfill your promises and you become my God, then I'm going to live generously with you. A man who just spent the better part of his life trying to get all he can out of the world is transformed into a generous man. So another question to ask yourself, do you know the Lord? Is he changing you? Are you living more generously? And this isn't just about money, though it has to do with money, because money is such a stronghold on us. And so maybe a couple of questions is, if you call this Life Connection your church, are you giving toward the mission of the church? Are you doing that consistently? Is it a priority to you? Like, one way you could do that is through the Church Center app. You can actually set it up to automatically, for you to automatically give a certain amount at a certain time every month. And as summer hits and we start to spread out and we start to go on trips, like, maybe that's something you can do to make sure that you are continuing to be generous and supporting the mission of the local church. But beyond financially, like, the Lord has blessed us with so much more. How are you using your gifts and your talents? Are you using those to serve others? How are you using the things that the Lord has given you? Are you using those to be hospitable and loving? Like I heard her saying recently that to feel like you've been heard feels a lot like being loved. Are you willing in a conversation to be the person who prioritizes listening above speaking? Like generosity is such a hallmark of the Christian life because it is so easily displays the gracious, generous heart of our God. We have nothing to offer the Lord, and yet He has given us everything. And so, as we prepare to take the Lord's Supper together, as we prepare to walk out of this time together, what does it mean to you to know that the God who is majestic and glorious beyond all description, the one who spoke all the stars into existence, and knows every single one of them by name, also knows you? What does it mean for you this morning that in knowing every part of you, He has loved you and generously given His life for you? And how, in knowing that, will it change you? Because as you take the Lord's Supper, those of us who are followers of Christ, we're reminding ourselves that Jesus gave of His body and of His blood to forgive and atone our sins so that we could now have new life filled with the Spirit of God, guaranteed for eternity to be in the presence of God. Knowing that, how will you respond and move forward? Let's take hold of this together and let's walk out of here committed to live a life in His presence. Let's pray.